since moved past, an embarrassing relic of what Europe used to be, excommunicated like a relative who'd committed an unspeakable crime. No one would think to search for him there. What's the worst that can happen? You could die. You're already dead, Reese. He went below to the small bookshelf in the boat's salon and took down a copy of World Cruising Routes by Jimmy Cornell. Spreading the boat's charts on the table, he began studying possible routes and grinned to himself when he read that the best time to make this journey was between May and June. It was November. So much for good timing. According to his GPS, he was currently halfway between Bermuda and the Azores on what was listed as Route AN-125. At 5 knots, it should take an average sailor just over 18 days to reach the Azores. A professional could push the Beneteau at an ideal wind angle of 11 knots. Reese considered himself more of a wayward mariner than a sailor, but he was learning quickly. How long had he been at sea? He'd lost track in the storms and emotions after departing Fisher's. Was it possible he'd only been at sea for 2 weeks? Depending on the weather and his ever-improving skills, he estimated he would reach landfall in 10 to 12 days. The Azores would allow him to rest up, make any necessary repairs to the boat, and, in an emergency, possibly even resupply. The dilemma was what route to take after the Azores. He could catch the winds to Gibraltar, enter the Med, and eventually head down the Suez Canal and into the Indian Ocean. That would be the most direct route, but it would leave him the most exposed to immigration and customs agencies from legitimate governments, many of which had close ties to the security apparatus of the United States. Gibraltar was covered with British intelligence assets, and the U.S. enjoyed close relations with nearly every country that touched the Med, save for Libya, which was a country in name only at this point. Reese had no idea what kind of screening took place at the mouth of the Suez, but he had to assume they didn't just wave boats through such a strategically important waterway. No. The direct route wouldn't do at all. He'd have to take it the long way around the continent. It was summer below the equator, which meant the winds were mostly favorable. From his reading, it was actually the ideal time of year to make that journey. But it was a long way to sail solo. It would be tough, but not impossible. Besides, it would give him an objective to focus on, something that always helped him make it through hard times. The key was to keep your eye on the ball and take it one event, one day, one run at a time. Just make it to breakfast, then to lunch. Keep moving forward. Reese's study of the routes book established he had already erred by taking too far south a course, though he missed out on more favorable winds by steering the course he chose. He did have better weather. The temperatures were relatively warm, and the high-pressure system gave him clear skies. He found himself using the motor more than he would have liked, thanks to intermittent headwinds and calms, but he was confident that he'd have sufficient fuel to make it through this stretch of ocean. "Don't get too comfortable, Reese. You'll probably die en route anyway." Chapter 9. Essex County, Southern England, December. With its 2nd Battalion of the Parachute Regiment back from its most recent deployment to Afghanistan, the 16 Air Assault Brigade had nearly all its troops at Colchester Garrison in time for the Christmas holiday. Several members of 2 Para were receiving awards for valor, and the ceremony, with all the pomp and circumstance that the British Army has to offer, had been celebrated in the local media. The garrison was on a heightened state of alert due to the recent terrorist attack in London. Barricades slowed approaching vehicles, giving base security cameras additional time to evaluate the passengers. Scales determined if a car or truck was unusually heavy and might be loaded down with explosives. Multipurpose canine teams patrolled between vehicles as they waited patiently to show the guards their identification cards. The entire battalion, along with numerous other units from the brigade, formed up on the asphalt parade ground off Roman Way. Dressed in multicam fatigues and sporting their trademark maroon berets, the paras were the pride of the British Army. On this special occasion, the Parachute Regiment's Colonel-in-Chief, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, would be attending the ceremony and decorating the troops. The Prince's motorcade had been slowed by uncharacteristically bad traffic, delaying the start time. So the troops stood, shivering in formation, as the band played every patriotic tune they could muster to pass the time for the visiting dignitaries. To a man, the paras were anxious to put the ceremony behind them. Their holiday leave would begin upon the conclusion of the events, and after a long overseas deployment, they were looking forward to spending some time with their wives, girlfriends, mates, or favorite bartenders. The band's proximity to the troop formation made it impossible for the soldiers to hear anything but the music as they passed the time until His Majesty's arrival. As the minutes ticked by, even the senior non-commissioned officers began to grow impatient. The Al-Jalil is an Iraqi copy of the Yugoslavian-made M69A 82mm mortar. Three of them had been placed in a triangular formation in the small backyard of a home on Wickham Road just north of Colchester Garrison. The crew was highly experienced, having fired similar weapons on hundreds of occasions on both sides of the Syrian conflict. Their leader, whom they knew only as Hayyan, had been an artillery officer in Assad's army before switching sides and eventually migrating through Greece and into mainland Europe. He had been recruited for this job months earlier and had spent long hours training his team, supervising daily rehearsals, and reconnoitering the target once it was established. A woman with a sweet English voice had reserved the home for the week, sight unseen, under the auspices of a golf escape for her husband and a few of his friends from London. Google Maps and a close target reconnaissance had confirmed it as an ideal location. They had moved into the rental house the evening prior and painstakingly positioned their weapons inside a shed in the backyard to conceal them from nosy neighbors and overhead surveillance. If their golf bags and luggage were heavier than normal, no one seemed to notice. Now it was time to execute the mission for which they had so carefully trained. The flimsy, corrugated tin roof of the shed was pushed aside, having been detached from its screws the night before. Sight blocks were double and triple checked, and ammunition was laid out for fast access. Hayyan told the men to take their positions and watched the minute hand on his watch tick toward the time they'd been given by their handler.
Talata, Itnan, Wahid, Ner.
The men responded instantly to his command, releasing the high explosive rounds into the tubes before ducking out of the way as each weapon fired. Because the target was far closer than the maximum range of 4,900 meters, the tubes were placed at a high angle, which meant that the second and third volleys had been fired before the first rounds impacted. The first three rounds landed simultaneously, with each round carrying a kilogram of explosive and accompanying shrapnel. Two of the rounds impacted within the close ranks of the troops' formation, obliterating those in the immediate blast area and maiming dozens nearby. The third round impacted the parade deck in front of the troops and actually caused more wounded, the shrapnel dispersing over a wider spectrum. Those men not killed or wounded by the first volley were saved by the instincts that were still sharp from their time overseas. They hit the deck almost in unison, the call of incoming echoing across the parade ground. The members of the band had no such survival instincts and stood in shock as the second volley landed in and around their formation. As the second volley found its mark, the regimental sergeant major took action.
3 o'clock, 300 meters,
yelled the veteran of three wars, dating back to his first taste of combat at Goose Green in the Falkland Islands. The troops responded without hesitation, sprinting from the kill zone and doing their best to drag their wounded comrades with them. Dignitaries dove under the bleachers and band members scattered in every direction as the third and fourth volleys landed. The paras grabbed every piece of cover that they could find and immediately began treating the wounded. Belts became tourniquets and uniform jackets became pressure dressings as they fought to save their dying mates. While the men lay bleeding and screaming, the final volley impacted the parade ground. 2nd Battalion, which had survived the rigors of 9 months in Afghanistan without losing a soul, had just been decimated on home soil. By the time the echoes from the explosions faded, the mortar crew had already piled into vans and were driving toward London. Chapter 10. Basel, Switzerland. December. The London financial markets, barely recovering from the sell-off that followed the attack at Kingston Market, plunged deeper into recession on the news of the second terrorist attack in the span of a few days. The hysteria of fear affected holiday shopping across Europe and even in the United States, with nearly every Western market plunging deeper into the red. Vasily Andrenov had learned early in his career that access to information meant access to wealth, and he parlayed the strategic information at his fingertips into financial power. When a Marxist revolution was planned in a key oil-producing nation, he had surreptitiously invested in oil futures, knowing that the price of crude would soon spike. As he rose in rank and influence, he moved on to crafting specific intelligence operations for their potential market impact. The colonel had built a fortune creating chaos, prolonging conflicts, and disrupting regional commerce. If the world economy demanded lithium, Andrenov would use his men to stoke the flames of hatred among the tribes that occupied areas rich in that resource. Drop in some Soviet-made weapons on either side and sit back and watch the prices rise. Commodities and currencies were his focus in those days, but now, unable to manipulate the strategic assets of a superpower, he'd shifted his focus to more basic events. Nothing spooked investors like terrorism, and after the fall of the Soviet Union, it had become his bread and butter. The Islamists were easy to influence, and with an investment of a few $100,000 and a few martyrs, he could move markets single-handedly. The latest string of attacks in Great Britain had earned him hundreds of millions of pounds, euros, and dollars, while serving the greater purpose of keeping the Western leaders and their budgets focused on chasing Muslim ghosts at home, instead of pursuing worthwhile strategic goals abroad. At age 67, Andrenov had a level of prosperity that ensured his fortune would outlive him, and without a wife or children to inherit the fruits of his labor, or a business that would move forward bearing his name, he would be a mere footnote outside classified channels. That wasn't entirely true. He did have one illegitimate son in Russia that he knew of, and probably a few more from postings around the globe that he didn't. He kept tabs on his son, more for the security implications to Andrenov's organization than out of any real concern for his well-being. His legacy wasn't flesh and blood, though. It was Russia. The moderates were killing his homeland, and he was finally in a position to do something about it. It was time to start investing in Russia, investing in her people. He would continue to profit, of course, as that gave him freedom, but he would use his puppet strings to move his motherland back to its rightful place in history. Just as he'd single-handedly built and destroyed nations and economies, he would now rebuild Imperial Russia. Chapter 11. Langley, Virginia. December. Oliver Gray glanced at the battered 1960s vintage Rolex Submariner on his wrist for the fifth time in as many minutes. Almost 5 p.m. Time to go. He removed his access card from the card reader on his desk, leaving the computer on so it could automatically update with any security patches overnight. It was a far cry from the old days of locking paper files in safes, or the more recent days of pulling hard drives and locking those in the same safes that once held the paper files. He did miss those paper files, though. So many more precautions were required now that it almost took the fun out of it. Almost. He slid his desk chair into his cubicle and said goodbye to his section chief, a woman much younger than his 58 years, almost forgetting his charcoal gray overcoat. Virginia was cold this time of year. The beauty of the building was completely lost on him as he wove his way through the halls past men and women walking with purpose, some just starting their day. If any of the attractive females who seemed to appear from around every corner paid him any unlikely attention, he didn't notice. Logging out through the security checkpoint between him and the parking lot was a mundane matter, something he had done almost every day for the past 30 years. He nodded at one of the uniformed security guards who seemed to look right through him. It didn't bother Oliver. He was accustomed to being overlooked. His puffy white skin, plain off-the-rack suit and comb-over hair made him essentially invisible among the younger, fitter, better-dressed staffers he passed on his way out. Oliver didn't have an assigned parking space, even with so much time invested with the company, and he briefly found himself turned around in the massive lot before realizing he had parked on the other side. He trudged his way there, got into his car, and lit a pipe with a wooden match. He'd started smoking a pipe because he thought it less vulgar than the cigarettes that were smoked in abundance by many of his colleagues back when he started. To the new generation, smoking was seen as a weakness rather than an activity to be enjoyed or a tool to start casual conversations that were anything but. Still, the tobacco warmed his lungs and filled the car with the aroma he so loved. Putting it in drive, he moved slowly through the parking lot of the Central Intelligence Agency and out onto George Washington Memorial Parkway. Gray didn't drive the 1987 VW Jetta because he couldn't afford a newer car. He kept it because it was the only purchase he had made with his first payment as a spy for what was then the Soviet Union.
A long time ago, Gray remembered, before the wall came down. Before the world changed.
He'd bought the car used so as not to arouse suspicion, mindful of the Jaguar that Aldrich Ames had driven before the FBI had tightened their noose. Even then, large purchases were flagged by the Counterintelligence Division, and though the James Angleton era had long since passed, the spy hunter's specter still haunted the halls of his former agency. Oliver's great-grandparents had immigrated to the United States from Russia following the chaos of the October Revolution and settled in Penn Wynn, Pennsylvania. They insisted on always speaking Russian in the home to preserve and pass on what was left of their heritage. Oliver's mother, Veronica, continued the tradition, albeit a bit diluted, giving her son the gift of understanding the intricacies of another language and culture. What memories Gray had of his father were now the type that made him wonder if they were real or figments of his imagination. As a traveling salesman, Oliver's father was rarely home, always on the road peddling encyclopedias, kitchen utensils, laundry soap, coupon booklets, and anything else that might keep his family clothed and fed. It was while selling bath bars during one of those trips that he met a widow in Philadelphia. As his trips to the big city became